You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme:
President Putin waged the war against the West, and he believes that Ukraine is just a playing field for him. Putin's action is a threat to everyone.
Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk there. Almost 1,000 people have been killed in eastern Ukraine since a ceasefire supposedly came into place 2.5 months ago. We'll discuss this and the day's other major stories with Jim Hoare and Mary Dajewski. Then we meet the artist taking portraits of cockatoos in Australian forests.
I'm so interested in the character and the personality of animals. That's kind of where I've always been passionate about it, is when I see an animal, I see that it's incredibly beautiful, but it's about how do you get the character out.
We'll also discuss an upcoming book prize in the UK and take a look at the latest Italian news weeklies. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, as you would expect here on Midori House, rather a lot to cram into the next 60 minutes. And first, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The death rate in the Ukraine conflict has increased in the past 8 weeks, despite the declaration of a ceasefire. The United Nations report says more than 4,300 combatants and civilians have been killed in eastern Ukraine since pro-Russian rebels seized border regions in April. Nearly 1 million people have fled the area, with a surge in the past 2 months. The report by UN Human Rights Monitors says, on average, 13 soldiers, rebels and civilians have died every day since a formal ceasefire was agreed by Ukraine, Russia and the rebels in early September. The previous report issued on the 8th of October had put the daily death toll at 10. Gianni Magazzani, senior spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says monitors have observed large numbers of weaponry and foreign fighters in the region.
We have also increasing report of torture, arbitrary detention, summary execution, forced labor, sexual violence. Individuals that were held by the armed groups and have been able to talk in freedom with our monitoring missions have revealed very disturbing details of their situations in conditions of detention.
A Swedish appeals court has denied WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's latest request to dismiss an arrest warrant for alleged rape and molestation. He says the cases are false and politically motivated. The 43-year-old has been living in London's Ecuadorian embassy for more than 2 years to avoid extradition to Sweden. Prosecutors there want to question him about the sexual assault allegations that date from 2010. Mr. Assange, who's not been charged, says he's afraid Sweden would extradite him to the United States, where he could face the death penalty if he's convicted of publishing government secrets through WikiLeaks. North Korea has threatened to carry out further nuclear tests in response to calls for an investigation into claims of human rights abuses. On Tuesday, the UN put forward recommendations asking the Security Council to consider referring North Korea to the International Criminal Court. It followed a UN report published in February that listed wide-ranging abuses in North Korea. New York State is facing another huge snowstorm, which could leave some areas under more than 2.5 metres of snow by Friday. At least 8 people are known to have died so far, 5 from heart attacks. Hundreds were trapped in their homes or vehicles after the first blast of snow hit the northeast of the United States. A state of emergency has been declared in Buffalo after nearly 2 metres of snow swept into the city from across Lake Erie. The storm trapped more than 100 vehicles along a 132-mile stretch of the New York State Thruway, the state's main highway that was closed on Wednesday. These Buffalo residents are managing as well as they can.
This is the worst I've seen. It's bad. Probably about 10 blocks over, it's a lot worse, but it's pretty bad here as well.
It's not as bad as 1977, but it's pretty bad, especially with all the shutdowns and bans and everything. So it's a little bit harder for people to get around.
Nigerian security forces have fired tear gas inside parliament just before a crucial debate on security in the conflict-hit northeast. Reports say the police were trying to stop House of Representatives Speaker Aminu Tambuwal from entering. Mr. Tambuwal defected to the opposition from the ruling PDP last month. His former colleagues have since argued he should be stripped of his speaker role. Director Mike Nichols, one of the few people to win an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar and a Tony Award, has died. He was 83. He directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate and was married to the former ABC World News anchor Diane Sawyer. He was born Michael Igor Peshkovsky in Berlin in 1931. He started his career on stage and in the 1950s co-founded the Chicago-based comedy troupe Second City, which encouraged many comedians, including John Belushi and Bill Murray. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's just come up to 18:07 here in London, 16:07 in Sao Paulo, 13:07 in New York City. Joining us today here in the studio is the academic and historian Jim Hoare, a former British diplomat based in Seoul, Beijing and Pyongyang. And hopefully in a moment, we'll also be joined by Mary Dzhevsky, chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent. Mary is stuck in traffic near Park Lane. We wish her well. It's a killer at this time of night. We're going to begin, though, Jim, with you on North Korea, possibly your favourite subject. The country's government has threatened to carry out a nuclear test after a UN Human Rights Committee called for North Korea to be referred to the International Criminal Court. Jim, before I speak to you, let's hear first from Aidan Foster-Carter, who we heard from a little earlier on the briefing. He explained why North Korea is getting worried.
Well, this is a new twist, admittedly. It's been a very good year for people who think that the human rights issue in North Korea, grotesque abuses, has been underplayed in the past. No one can say that now. The UN went beyond the ritual annual condemnation by commissioning a report. Just to sort of sum up very briefly, I'm sure your well-informed listeners probably know all this. That came out in February. It was very detailed and damning. The wheels of the UN grind quite slowly, so we've only just had the UN, a committee of the UN General Assembly, passing this resolution, which, and the new thing, sorry to get to the point, is a referral to the International Criminal Court. North Korea's allies, such as Cuba, tried to change the draft so that was taken out, but they failed. Whether he'll ever get sent to the court, I don't know. But obviously, it's such a personalized system. I don't know whether it's the case that Kim Jong-un personally fears for his extradition. I can't see that happening in any circumstances. But it's such a leader-centered system, and you know they treat him almost as godlike, that it's a kind of lèse majesté as much as a threat to do something like this. So yes, it has rattled them quite a lot.
That was Aidan Foster-Carter at Leeds University. Jim Hoare, how seriously should we take this threat? Because, you know, we've been used to threats from Kim Jong-un in the past.
Well, I think we've been used to threats from North Korea in the past. Or we've been, rather than threats, really, these are highly rhetorical statements, stating the high ground. Whether they would actually conduct a nuclear test because of this decision to refer it to the International Court or not is a different matter. I think they have their own program on nuclear matters that is actually driven by scientists and certain other things. And from time to time, they will want to do tests. That's much more important than this particular thing. But if you feel you are being pushed into a corner, if you feel you are being pilloried by the United States and the rest of those who joined in this exercise, then you respond with this sort of rhetoric, if you're North Korean. I don't think actually most countries would just ignore what's been done if they are, like North Korea, a functioning state. And this is not something, this is not a place that's collapsed. There is a government, it operates. You may not like it, but it's there. And it will react to this sort of, as I said, pillaring as they see it.
Mary Tchaikovsky is here. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you.
Jim said, you know, North Korea is, you know, when it's pushed into a corner, it reacts. Do you think that we just have to accept that if nations are going to point out, quite rightly, North Korea's appalling human rights record, that there will be some reaction, and that's actually worth paying the price for essentially sort of keeping to our principles and also making it clear that we don't think this is acceptable?
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'm not sure it's quite the way I would look at it. I think that the response from North Korea shows, in a way, the lack of other avenues open to it to respond. The way maybe they feel that they can be taken seriously abroad, the only way is to threaten their nuclear weapon. And I think that, in a way, that is illustrative of the whole problem between North Korea and everybody else, which is that they have only this degree of leverage. And I think the difference, as it were, the gap between the rhetoric, which is what they're using, and maybe the intention actually to do something, is probably quite large. But I also wouldn't mind betting that they quite enjoy the sort of panicked and slightly scared reaction that they see abroad, because it shows that there has been some sort of effect.
Yeah. I just want to, sorry, Jim, before we come to you, Mary, just push you on that. When you say, you know, that this is the only way that they're able to react, what could be done differently then to give them another avenue, another outlet?
I think one day, hopefully, we're going to see that North Korea is going to be brought into the fold instead of being treated as this sort of pariah. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, I think it's entirely understandable that the question of human rights, the prison camps, the torture, all the dreadful things that go on in North Korea, that the rest of the world, or at least a lot of the rest of the world, wants to make an issue of it. But I think that it has driven North Korea into a corner where the only way that they can think they'll get some sort of notice and some sort of, quote, respect is by wielding the one thing that they've got, which is this nuclear threat.
Jim, why shouldn't Western nations, though, actually say, we disagree with your human rights record and we're not going to, you know, we're not going to shut up and be nice about it?
Because it's not actually helping anybody who's involved. I mean, my great problem with this, and I've exchanged bitter words with one or two people who are very strongly involved in North Korean human rights issues, is that this is grandstanding. It's very reassuring to those for whom this is an important subject that they do this, that they bring this to the attention. And then what happens? Well, basically, to those in the camp, very little. Or in some cases, we've heard from other places, they actually things actually get worse for a time because people say, right, okay, it's all your fault. We're going to beat you up. So if you want to modify North Korea's human rights behavior, you don't do it in this grand manner like this, because that will not get through to them. What you do is you work at the lower level, you do it quietly, you, as they would say, you respect our dignity as a state. We are a state and we should be treated like other states. And you pick on those states that you want to raise human rights issues. There are human rights issues in most countries. You can take the wind out of North Korean sails by saying to them, we have human rights problems in this country, and here's the sort of issue we have. We've done that with them, and it did work. But the other thing is that to the North Koreans, this is not about human rights. This is about pushing them, trapping them, getting them. And that is a very dangerous sort of position to put them in.
Mary, we're going to come on to the situation with Russia and Ukraine in a moment. But do you see some similarities to how the West deals with North Korea? And as Jim says, you know, grandstanding and making the point that they want to make to be seen to be doing what they're doing, with the way that Many leaders in the West have dealt with Vladimir Putin as well.
I think there's been a lot of that, especially obviously over Ukraine. I think it's also unfortunate that it creates this impression of double standards, especially now with North Korea, but also with Russia and with other countries. Because, of course, the North Korea issue about human rights is about some preliminary sort of process on the way to the International Criminal Court. And, of course, the United States is not party to the whole International Criminal Court process. It doesn't recognise the International Criminal Court. So it's all very well for them to sort of piggyback on accusations against North Korea, but it's not good enough for American citizens. And, you know, the North Koreans could well turn around and say, well, it's not good enough for you, it's not good enough for us.
Jim, on this issue of how Western nations should deal with this, you know, some people would say, well, look, when, and I realise these comparisons aren't, you know, in any way accurate, but, you know, when South Africa was under apartheid, we didn't simply accept that. There were protests, there was opposition, there were boycotts. We did what we could. And if we hadn't, then maybe apartheid would still exist. Now, that analogy may not be true, but I mean, can you point to, you know, other examples where countries have followed the route you're suggesting of let's play this down, let's be nice, and it's worked out better?
I first went to China in 1976, and I've been back to China many times since, and I lived there between 1988 and 1991. And as I've said before on this program and other programs, if you had told me that developments within China in terms of personal liberties and so on, of course it's not perfect, but the changes that have taken place in China, not brought about by saying to the Chinese, we're going to take Mr. Deng Xiaoping to the International Court of Justice, but actually engaging with the Chinese, providing training. If you'd told me that we're going to be training Chinese, young Chinese judges in London 25 years ago, I'd have said, don't be daft. But that's happened. There are ways of doing it, and it is right to raise human rights issues. But in the case of North Korea, it's always done at the highest level of rhetoric and the lowest level of involvement, and that isn't necessarily the right way of doing it.
I think there's a very great danger in making countries that already feel insecure, making them feel even less secure. It's then that they become dangerous and a threat.
Let's move on now to the situation in eastern Ukraine. A ceasefire was supposedly agreed 2.5 months ago, but the violence hasn't stopped. As you heard earlier on the news, the UN now believes an average of 13 people have been killed every day since then in the region. That's nearly 1,000 since the truce came into force. Mary Dzhevsky, despite the fact that, you know, other things distract us, other world headlines have perhaps replaced Ukraine at the top of the news bulletins. This is incredibly serious what's going on, and nothing really seems to be changing, does it?
I think it is very serious. I also think that, you know, 13 people a day, 1,000 people since the start of the supposed ceasefire. Yes, this is a lot of people. It especially seems a lot of people because it's really in our backyard. You know, this is Europe. But I also think we should look at it in terms of how much worse it could have been if the ceasefire had not been agreed. Things were considerably worse. The fatalities were many greater before the ceasefire was agreed. And the fighting, such as it is going on now in a very limited area. This doesn't mean things are wonderful, but I think things are better, and the ceasefire is actually holding better than a lot of people expected.
And Jim Hoare, you know, the situation in Russia is now pretty bad when you look at the state of the economy, you know, partly due to those sanctions, partly due to falling oil prices. But that's, at the moment, doesn't seem as if that's going to affect Vladimir Putin's strategy in eastern Ukraine, does it?
I don't see any sign whatsoever that it's affecting his strategy. In fact, again, it's one of those things that the more you push at him, the more he's likely to insist on sticking with the position he's in and following the policies he's in. And I suspect that some of the as the winter comes on and the gas and so on does or does not flow, that you might start seeing modifications in some of the Western policies, or some of the European policies, let's not just limit it to the West. But it is serious. But it could have been so much worse. And it did at one point look as though it was going to be an awful lot worse. And the signs are that this is, in a way, going the same way as the previous conflicts with Georgia and other places on the border, that it's sort of settling down into a not very satisfactory, by anybody's reckoning, little war of attrition, but it's not actually blowing into a much bigger thing, which at one point it looked as though it might.
Mary, why do you think it's not as bad as it was? Is this, I hesitate to suggest this, but a victory for European diplomacy, for the tough sanctions they imposed on Vladimir Putin? Is it, and I hesitate even more saying this, because of the wonderful politicians in Kiev who've finally grasped the nettle and shown themselves to stand up to the plate? What is it that you think has led us to this slightly better, if still pretty terrible, situation?
I think there's a combination of things, but I think the least contribution has actually come from Kiev. I think there has been a degree of European diplomacy, including behind the scenes, after what looked like the great standoff shouting match at the G20 in Brisbane last week. It now turns out that there was actually a degree of diplomacy behind the scenes, and actually several of European leaders have actually been calling for talks in some forum. So I think that is partly a degree of progress. I also think that there is considerable indecision in Moscow about what to do next, and there's disagreement about how far to press on eastern Ukraine. The amount of territory in dispute in eastern Ukraine is actually very small. And my personal view is that Russia doesn't actually want any more territory, that it can't afford to have any more territory, and it doesn't want another land grab. The problem is that how far the rebels in eastern Ukraine, how far they're actually under Russia's control, which I think is not very much, and how far they actually require Russian support in order to function. And I think in some ways there is now a choice for Russia. It has to decide whether it's going to support them more, in which case that conflict will indeed become a continuing war of attrition, or whether they're going to let them loose and say, well, you know, if you can't survive on your own, then Ukraine gradually, the authorities in Kiev are going to take over that bit of territory which they don't control at the moment.
Let's pause just for a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests are Mary Dajewski and Jim Hoare. We're back after this.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests are Jim Hoare and Mary Dajewski. In the US later tonight, President Barack Obama is expected to lay out his plans to change rules affecting millions of undocumented migrants living in America. It seems that he is going to use his executive powers to push through a plan. The Republicans are already vowing to fight this initiative. Before we hear from Jim and Mary, here's Xenia Wickett from Chatham House, who discussed this earlier on The Briefing.
There have been all sorts of other things on the agenda, and the amount of political energy that this requires is actually political energy that has been used to move forward other agenda items, whether they're economic, whether they're in the environmental space, whether they're foreign policy, etc. And so this competes with that political energy. What he's doing now is essentially saying, I don't have the political energy or the political support to be able to put this through a bill, which is how most people would like to see it change. I'm just going to do it by executive order. That leads a certain amount of uncertainty 2 years down the road.
That's Xenia Wickett from Chatham House. Jim Hoare, I mean, President Obama can say, look, I've tried to do this before and it's got stuck. You know, the Senate agreed something, but the House representatives refused. And now I don't control the Senate. I won't get through there. We all agree something needs to be done. I'm just going to do it.
Yes, that's fine. And one can understand why he's doing it. And it will work in the short term, but whether it will work in the long term, I don't know. I think it's unlikely because the Republicans, who now feel they've tasted blood, will pursue him on this and on other issues as well. But he clearly feels that you can't just let the thing drift on and drift on and drift on, with more people coming and more cases appearing in the press all the time. Immigration always makes hard press for governments. You can't win on it, and so it's understandable that he, faced with the apparently insoluble problem through the normal legislative channels, he's trying to do it this way. But as I say, I don't think it will provide a long-term solution, but it may get things going at the moment. The danger is that the confrontation with the Republicans, and you have the usual block on government expenditure.
But they're going to do that anyway, aren't they? I mean, we've been here before that, you know, Obama tries to make compromises with them and they block him anyway and take them to, you know, whether it's on the debt ceiling or on the budget itself. You know, I agree. Whatever he does, he does that. Marianne, on this issue of what happens post-Obama, if this goes through, is a Republican president, let's say a Republican is elected in 2016, thinking about how he or she wins again in 2020 and about the future of the Republican Party, really going to take away citizenship or a right to remain or the vote from 5-6 million new voters, mainly Hispanic?
Well, I think that's actually a very good question, because I think probably not, because George W. Bush was actually very liberal on immigration.
Surprisingly, back when he called himself a compassionate conservative.
Yes, and surprisingly so for somebody who was seen as quite a very ideological and quite right-wing Republican. But of course, he came from a southern state, Texas, with a very large Hispanic minority, possibly becoming eventually a majority. And he understood in a way that a lot of other state governors and US Congress people actually didn't, how much support you can actually garner politically, whether you're on the left or on the right of American politics, from the, especially the Hispanic community, but from migrants in general. So I think that we can't even forecast that a future Republican president would necessarily be tougher on migration than a Democrat.
And just finally, in the UK, it seems that our next king may be challenging some old traditions. While the Queen keeps her political views to herself, the heir to the throne, Prince Charles, has been less reticent. He writes letters to ministers and isn't against speaking out publicly when he sees fit. When, if he becomes king, that should change. But The Guardian today claims that Charles is determined to continue speaking out on issues that matter to him. Jim Hoare, you're a former British diplomat. Have you ever received any of these letters from Prince Charles? Have you?
No. As far as I know, he's never taken any interest in North Korean matters. But,
And what would you have? How would you have responded if? Yeah, let's say if the king was to say, I actually think we should be doing this instead.
Well, we're a long way from that yet, and I suspect that offices mould people, and that whatever Prince Charles does now. And we don't always know exactly what he does. There's lots of rumours going around.
Well, indeed. I mean, there's all sorts of letters that haven't been released.
That haven't been released.
That he's written,
exactly.
That we don't know what he said, we don't know what he thinks, and he's going to be the King of England.
But he clearly,
and everywhere else.
Yes.
Not just England, Wales, Northern Scotland.
He clearly has strong views on things, and he's entitled to those views. I'm sure other members of the royal family do as well. We get occasional hints from the Duke of Edinburgh that he has views about things.
But foreigners.
Prince Charles is slightly better on the foreigners. But I think that some of this is sort of, pardon me, Mary, the journalist froth that comes up from time to time, that we don't really know if there's anything in the story at all. But I think once in office as king, assuming it all goes smoothly and all the rest of it, then he will find himself constrained by the pressures from the politicians, the pressures from the court, his own advisers. That it's one thing to behave like this when you don't have authority or power or whatever, however you describe the monarch. It's another thing to do it if you're actually in the post.
But Mary,
something slightly different, which is that yes, Charles has been outspoken, but he's been quite careful about the subject that he's been outspoken about, even as Prince of Wales. And they're things like architecture, agriculture, things that he could actually continue to speak out about without affecting the constitution, the unwritten constitution, too dreadfully if he becomes king.
Well, you've just said that the unwritten constitution, there's nothing stopping him doing whatever he wants, frankly, is there? Because we haven't written it down, what he's allowed to do.
That is true, but of course it's not just convention, but it's also practicalities and the national interest that he has to take into account.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to leave it there with Jim about to also point out why he disagrees with me. Jim Hoare and Mary Tchaikovsky, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, that was fun. Loads more to come in the second half of Midori House. We're going to be talking about cockatoos and also what is in this week's Italian news weeklies. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the headlines.
And the death rate in the Ukraine conflict has increased in the past 8 weeks, despite the declaration of a ceasefire. A United Nations report says more than 4,300 combatants and civilians have been killed in eastern Ukraine since pro-Russian rebels seized border regions in April. A Swedish appeals court has denied WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's latest request to dismiss an arrest warrant for alleged rape and molestation. He says the cases are false and politically motivated. The 43-year-old has been living in London's Ecuadorian embassy for more than 2 years to avoid extradition to Sweden. North Korea has threatened to carry out further nuclear tests in response to calls for an investigation into claims of human rights abuses. On Tuesday, the UN put forward recommendations asking the Security Council to consider referring North Korea to the International Criminal Court. And New York State is facing another huge snowstorm, which could leave some areas under more than 2.5 metres of snow by Friday. At least 8 people are known to have died so far, 5 from heart attacks. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. That slight rustle of magazine you could hear there. There we are, a bit more of it again. That there is, okay, not, that's enough, is David Pleasant, Monocle producer, and also, despite his very English-sounding name, Italian, who has with him in front of him the Italian news weeklies Espresso and Panorama. And David, you're going to give us a little flavour of what Italian readers can look forward to this week.
Well, I will start with L'Espresso, which is the cover story features Jean-Claude Juncker, the EU president. Basically, this has been all over Europe, kind of criticism of him, but it's really really reaching ahead, and Espresso are kind of ahead of the game with this. They've kind of gone through a list of why he should really leave, and this is really interesting. It's kind of unfortunately putting that those anti-European Brits, that it's proving them right, because obviously the right here in Britain was very against his appointment.
Yeah, although they were against him for different reasons than those that that he's now coming under fire from. This is all about tax and Luxembourg, isn't it?
Yeah, in his home country, and that's really fascinating about this report. And you know, we should keep saying that's why these weeklies are so good. They really kind of allow you to go in depth with these stories. So we've got loads of facts about what exactly was happening in Luxembourg, this tiny, incredibly rich country, when he was in charge. And this is, yeah, it goes back to these Lux leaks that various, they're being termed. So various newspapers, including L'Espresso, have been involved in digging up all sorts of leaks from the period 2002 to 2010, just itemising exactly who was involved in just not paying tax. We all know about Amazon and IKEA, but then, you know, Pepsi, Gazprom, Deutsche Bank, Procter & Gamble, and a whole slew of Italian companies as well.
And these are companies that decided to have headquarters or offshoots in Luxembourg and made either loans or funnel profits to these companies, then said, well, we'll have nothing, you know, there'll be very, very low tax rates there, so that will be a way of us avoiding taxes elsewhere.
Exactly.
Is the accusation.
It's the accusation, all under the watch of Jean-Claude Juncker, who now heads up Europe and is telling Italians to pay their taxes and be responsible citizens.
Well, so Italians should pay their taxes.
Of course, and actually tax is going to come up later in the review. But just to kind of end that story, focusing on Italy, the Espresso goes into no tax in Italy. So the companies, some of the companies that are being accused, they focus in on La Rinascente Group, the big department store chain, whose kind of lower end franchise Upim is a familiar sight on the Italian high street. They've basically charted out how Upim managed not to pay tax, and it's quite extraordinary. I mean, I don't want to bore everyone, but
no, go ahead.
There's something like kind of 14 different companies. I know this is normal practice in the world of finance and the corporate world, but it just kind of makes you realise there's all these companies with obscure names with the word Luxembourg in it, with the SARL and SPI and all these acronyms. That's just basically all a way for Upim, that familiar chain store, not to pay its tax to the Italian state. And the banks went, you know, it wasn't just Luxembourg involved. It was Malta, the Cayman Islands, through Germany, through Deutsche Bank, back through Italian banks. Really interesting stuff, really.
And L'Espresso is giving us a huge amount of space, aren't they? So it's not just on the cover, but inside over. How many spreads is that all over?
It goes on with, so that there's two spreads on the companies. Then there's several spreads, two or three spreads on Luxembourg. Yeah. So it's a big story.
And tell us a bit about L'Espresso, because there's, you know, we're going to come on to Panorama as well. There are two main news weeklies, but they have obviously very different ownerships and very different views.
Yeah, that's right. Espresso is owned by the RCS group that also controls La Repubblica. So left-leaning daily and has always been staunchly against the trials and tribulations of Berlusconi. But I would say that within the RCS group, there are also fairly populist and right-leaning kind of tatty magazines that you might call. So it's not so, you know, I'd like to think that the system isn't so skewed to the left or right as that. But we should mention that, of course, Panorama, the next magazine, yes, that we're going into, is part of the Mondadori group, who we all know who owns that.
Silvio Berlusconi.
That's right.
For those who perhaps didn't. So let's take a look at Panorama, which is, talk us through, first of all, that weird front page. There's a man in a suit and he's got a big piece of paper in front of his face. What does that say on it?
Yeah, it's got the initials TFR and then it says Ti frego I risparmi, which means I'm going to steal your savings. TFR, it's a play on words because TFR is an acronym that stands for the redundancy payment that Italians all by law receive when they lose their job. And the state, the current government is trying ever so hard to stop those very generous payments, to try and free up the labour market in some way, to make sure that, you know, in the same way that Germany went through a few years ago.
this is all about making it slightly less difficult for companies to be able to fire workers that they want to get rid of, but perhaps actually can't afford to get rid of.
That's right. And it's a big inequality in Italy where you have these jobs that are just, you know, unsackable people who are earning, you know, very high salaries with big fat pensions. And then you've got people with no contracts whatsoever who are struggling to get onto the work market. So that's the focus of the cover story on Panorama.
And let's face it, a story about tax evasion is not the sort of story that Panorama, owned by Mr. S. Berlusconi, is ever likely to run, is it?
You never know, Steve. I don't want to be so bleak as to say that. But there's some other stories in here, if we've just got time for one more.
Yeah, you've got time for one quick one, yeah.
A nice kind of piece in Panorama about what they're calling the Steve Jobs of Italy. So his name is Nerio Alessandri, and he is the founder of Technogym, the gym manufacturer.
We know Technogym.
We've
featured Technogym before in Monaco. I've always been slightly unsure about the name, but actually the company seems quite good.
Is it the music that kind of puts you off?
It just makes me think of people in a gym doing techno.
Maybe. What's quite interesting, the parallel with him and Steve Jobs, they both started in a garage where he tested out his
there
equipment.
We are. If you start out in a garage testing out your equipment, you'll go far, says David Pleasant. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we're talking about cockatoos.
With a global network of bureau and correspondents, Monocle has just opened up its newest regional base in the heart of Istanbul. Dedicated to covering the Eastern Mediterranean, Central Asia and the Middle East, Joseph Dana is our man in Istanbul.
Separated by the Bosphorus Strait and spanning two continents, Istanbul has always been an ideal place to survey the region and make sense of the ever-changing puzzle that is the Middle East. From reports at the Syrian border to commentary from the ground in the Gaza Strip, we have you covered in this rapidly changing patch at the center of the international media.
From Ankara to Almaty, Tel Aviv to Tashkent, Joseph Dana is Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief and our correspondent for the region. Catch his reports on The Globalist and our other daily flagship programmes and across our weekly magazine shows right here on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24. Sydney-based artist Layla Jeffries spent 2 years photographing Australian wild cockatoos. Her series of portraits, which can be seen from tomorrow at the Purdy Hicks Gallery in London, are not only colourful, they also have some uncanny human resemblances. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met Layla Jeffries to find out more.
I am deeply passionate about Australian birds, and we have in particular amazing cockatoo species of birds. So I set myself out on basically a 2-year plan to do an exhibition on all the different native species of cockatoos. So it took me about 2 years to do the work, basically because I was working with rescue and release birds. So the idea is that we have all these amazing wildlife carers out there, and they basically get the birds that come into care and they rehabilitate them. And before they released them, I would take their portrait. And that's how I started. So it was a long, slow process.
Now, how was the process for the picture? Because it's like a portrait picture. Mm. Can you describe the size of the picture and how did you take those pictures?
That was my biggest dilemma. I'm so interested in the character and the personality of animals. That's kind of where I've always been passionate about it, is when I see an animal, I see that it's incredibly beautiful, but it's about how do you get the character out? And then the problem was, how do you photograph them in a way that they are relaxed enough to show their true character? So what I ended up devising, which took me a long time to sort of work out, was what I would sort of call like a miniature bird studio. I basically built like a small room that essentially had a door, which, you know, a bird would walk through, and there's a little back paper of roll that the bird would stand in front of, and there was a little perch. And any bird that goes into any little enclosure, if they see a perch, they want to be on top of it. So essentially, the way it was built, it had sort of perspex so that I could light it, and there was a little black cloth and a hole for me to be able to get my camera through. And the idea was, we got the birds used to being in that environment, so they weren't nervous. And once they were in it, they basically just started doing cockatoo things, just hanging out. And I would talk to them, and it was usually through the talking that the expression would come.
They're very expressive because, of course, I mean, it's no surprise that they're beautiful. I mean, they have, a very distinctive colors as well.
Yes.
But they're posing for the camera.
Yes, yes.
Why do you think that is?
Because they're cockatoos. I mean, parrots are, they're part of the parrot family, and they are just, they're the most human-like of any kind of species of bird. And if you talk to them and if you interact with them, they listen to you and they do pretty much pay attention. So, you know, it was a matter of me kind of getting them to a situation where they could tell that they were on show and they were relaxed in the environment they were in and they were listening to me talk. And every time they listen, you know, they tilt their head and they lift their crest up and there'd just be a moment that I'd be able to capture. And, you know, sometimes it would take a couple of shoots. You know, I would work with the same bird and I would come back another day and try and work with it again. But eventually all that expression and interaction is there and you would have it with a bird even if the camera wasn't there and you were just talking to them.
Who is Pete, for example? Look at his, he's so chic and mysterious in a way.
Pete was hilarious. So Pete was a total show-off, and he is, you can see. Actually, working with him was incredibly hard because he was such a show-off that I had to kind of keep trying to focus because he just kept moving and flicking his crest up and, you know, doing kind of steps back and forth. And he was very much a sort of Pete. He had a, I don't know, he just had a kind of showmanship thing about him.
I actually have a personal favorite from the pictures I've seen.
Yeah,
I do like Queenie.
I'm so glad you so like Queenie.
The plumage, you know, it's kind of grey and pink. I love this combination, first of all, but she looks very friendly as well.
She was so sweet. And you know what's really interesting is it's funny how I sort of have my own feeling of the birds because I've spent time with them, but I talk to people and when they see the portraits, because they're printed at human size, you know, they're printed to be so that we can view them as people. And with Queenie, I had one person tell me that she looked like a young girl that was getting her school photo taken and she was kind of, you know, kind of got that sort of stare about her where she knows she must pose and she must smile. And then somebody else thought that she looked like their grandmother that was clutching a handbag. So, you know, you have all these different types of ways that people view the birds when they see them.
I felt more the young girl vibe.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite?
So my favourite in terms of the cockatoos with the experience that I had was a cockatoo called Station. She's a palm cockatoo. To photograph her, I had to actually go to Adelaide Zoo, where she was the first palm cockatoo that's been successfully bred in captivity since, I think, 1973. So they're incredibly hard to breed in captivity and impossible for me to access through the wild. They live in the very, very top end of Australia. And she was the most insanely intelligent and curious bird. We had such a lovely experience together because she would come up and sort of look at me, but then she would fly away. You know, she just was a little bit nervous. I didn't photograph her in my little bird studio. In that situation, we were in kind of this big exhibit. As the shoot went on, she just started to realize that, you know, I could be a friend, and she was warming up to me. And by the end, she was kind of coming in and giving me little kisses in the neck and nuzzling in. I mean, I was kind of on the verge of tears by the end. It was actually a really emotional experience. So that's actually the artwork that I have at home because I just had such a great experience.
Do you have another project in the future with other types of birds perhaps?
I do, yeah. So I also have worked on a Birds of Prey series, which is, so Birds of Prey are sort of eagles and owls and kites, you know, buzzards, hawks. But I have so many different species of birds that I want to work with. None that I can really name at the moment. I think I have all these different ideas and I just have to go out and start to see what's possible. You're also limited by how you can get access to such rare and wild and interesting creatures. So it's definitely sticking with birds though. I think what people don't quite realise is within the different species, they are amazing. Like they're incredibly different and diverse. It's sort of like just because you've photographed and done one series and one species or type of bird, that doesn't mean you've got them all. They're so different and they've all evolved in such interesting ways. So I want to keep kind of documenting it.
There we are, some gratuitous cockatoo noises there to end that interview with Leila Jeffries by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that exhibition opens tomorrow at the Purdy Hicks Gallery in London. In a moment, we're talking books, but first, some music. This is We Are the People by Empire of the Sun. We Are the People by Empire of the Sun here on Monocle 24. Up next, some books. Ticking towards the end of the show. Before we go, as ever, a bit of an arts review. Today, it's books. Very pleased to be joined by Fleur MacDonald from The Omnivore. Fleur, welcome to Midori House. We're going to be talking about these awards. Now, they sound, you know, a little bit cheap, perhaps, but they're actually far from that. The Costa Coffee Awards. No one really goes, oh, yes, Costa Coffee. I want that on my mantelpiece. But it is actually quite a big prize here in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In fact, actually, I think it's one of my favourite literary awards now. They haven't sold out like the Booker, so they're still based in the UK. It's for writers who have been based in the UK for 6 months or more, or are from the UK. I rather like the way they pit genres against each other. So it becomes like a sort of Marvel Comics superheroes going against each other. So they do non-fiction. They have a non-fiction category, which is pitted against the fiction, and then the debut authors.
So they have all these different separate prizes, and then they sort of bring them all together at the end for the grand prize, which might be poetry, might be novel, might be non-fiction.
Yeah, or children's, in fact. I think the last children's book that won the Costa Coffee Awards was Philip Pullman's The Amber Spyglass, which was a great book.
It was a great novel, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it really showed that, you know, young adult fiction is something to be reckoned with.
Which are the ones which you'd like to see do well?
Well, in the fiction category, there are four books. There's Ali Smith's How to Be Both, which was longlisted for the Booker. There's Neil Mukherjee's The Lives of Others, which is kind of a 500-page epic about a Indian family in the 1960s, which got reviewed very well. It got to the shortlist of the Booker, but obviously didn't make it. We've got House of Ashes by Monique Roffey, and that she was actually nominated for the Orange Prize once. So she's back on the front pages with her book that tells the fictional account of a revolution in the 1990s in kind of a banana republic. And that's meant to be very good, very gripping, pacey, and quite different from her previous books. And finally, we have Colm Tóibín's Nora Webster, which has been described as kind of a love song to a middle-aged widow in 1960s Ireland.
Well, there we are then. As descriptions go, that's not bad. Do you think that it's quite difficult for the judges to compare, you know, a novel with a piece of poetry to a children's book? Is there something inherently complicated about coming up with a winner out of all of those?
Yes, definitely. But I do think that the prize does a good job of bringing quite a few different genres to the public's attention. And I mean, that's basically what prizes are for. Mm. They're for the reading public. That obviously one lucky winner gets, I think it's 25,000 for the Costa Book Awards. But it means that lots more people start reading poetry, which, well, I know I should read more.
We should all read more poetry. Yeah. I mean, that is the thing, isn't it? That, you know, they all get, everyone that's shortlisted, yeah, you'll now see it on the 3 for 2 shelves, and you'll see it in displays in your local independent bookstores with that little coffee sticker on the front saying it's been nominated, it's been shortlisted. And so it does bring to our attention the sort of books that perhaps some of us don't always read.
And in fact, actually, the debut fiction category is quite interesting, because three of the books I've never heard of before. One is, it's A Song for Issy Bradley. It belongs to quite a growing genre, which is a debut novelist writing about cults. We've had Peggy Riley, who wrote about Midwest America cults. We've had Grace McLean, that won the Desmond Elliott Prize about 2 years ago, who wrote about some crazy people somewhere in Wales, which has got to be crazy. And so this one is about Mormons, and actually she grew up in a Mormon family, so it's based on her real life experiences. And I'm really looking forward to reading that. Elizabeth is Missing Emma Healy's, it's an incredible act of ventriloquism. I've read it. It's about an old woman who's suffering from dementia. And so you get plunged into her perspective. And it really does what fiction is meant to do, which is put you into the brain of someone else. So I'd really recommend that one. Otherwise, there's Chop Chop by Simon Rowe that sounds great fun. It's a satire on the London restaurant scene, if that needed satiring.
I think it can do with a little bit here and there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. So again, with all of those, it's, again, it's shining a light on books that, you know, could do with a bit of a leg up and perhaps don't always get it otherwise.
Yeah, I definitely think so. So I think the Costa, that sticker isn't a kiss of death like the Booker Prize is for me.
No, indeed. Wonderful. Fleur MacDonald from The Omnivore. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. And that's that for today's programme. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jim Hoare and Mary Dujewski. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Benoit Grogan-Avignon. The studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines with Bill, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned, of course, for the Michael Daly later on with Emma and Gillian DeBias. Midori House, back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.